Radio Free Maine presents Noam Chomsky speaking on the economic impact of post-World War II U.S. foreign policy. Thursday, April 27, 1995, Phillips Academy, Andover, Massachusetts. Sponsored by the Andover Economics Project and the Department of History and Social Science. Recorded for Radio Free Maine by Roger Leisner. We now join Noam Chomsky speaking on the economic impact of post-World War II U.S. foreign policy.
Shaped since the Second World War. I'd like to do it with an eye towards what's happening now, so I want to focus on how these same principles, which in fact go back hundreds of years in my opinion, are now sort of playing themselves out in somewhat new ways under new contingencies. And I'll try not to go on too long so we can have time to talk about things. Well, the Second World War is a pretty good place to start. Of course, history never begins, but it was a turning point, big turning point, obviously. The world changed considerably. That's one of the few times in history when the phrase New World Order is appropriate. One massive change was that one country, namely the United States, achieved a degree of global dominance that had absolutely no parallel in human history in terms of wealth, power, security, military force, technology, and so on. The United States was simply completely beyond parallel, and there was no doubt in anyone's mind that the United States was going to organize the international world order. In particular, there were no doubts in the minds of American planners who overwhelmingly come from the business sectors, which are domestically dominant, the corporate sector. They began, in fact, in 1939 to develop plans for the world order that would emerge out of the Second World War. Nobody knew then exactly what it was. There were studies undertaken by the Council on Foreign Relations, which sort of brings together the more internationally oriented sectors of the business community and some academics and a few others, and the State Department. The top planners in the State Department met from 1939 to 1945 in a series of quite important meetings called the War Peace Studies Group, in which they laid rather detailed plans for the future of the world, plans which were then in fact implemented. If you look at the declassified, there's a very rich declassified record of documents from running up to now about the early 60s. And if you look at the records for the late 40s, early 50s, they very closely follow the outlines of the planning that was set in motion during the Second World War. The basic idea was that they wanted to construct what they called a grand area, which would be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. The grand area was to include at least the Western Hemisphere, the Pacific, and the Middle East oil reserves, and of course Western Europe, and if possible, everything. Somewhere in between there and everything would be the grand area. In the early stages, it was assumed that there would also be a German-controlled area. So in the early 40s, it looked like Germany, major power, might emerge from the war as an alternative major force. They were concerned with the German-controlled world and the U.S.-controlled world. And then, of course, as became clear by about 1943 or so with the Russian victories in the Eastern Front, that Germany was not going to survive, they shifted to the idea of a grand order that would indeed be global. There was a question as to how the Soviet Union and its, at that time, no satellites, just the Soviet Union would be incorporated in it. And that really didn't get settled until the late 40s when it became not incorporated until the end of the Cold War. The basic contours of the grand area are an area subordinated to the needs of the American economy, and by 1945 that meant Western Europe, the entire Third World, everything except the Soviet Union and its satellites, and China at that time was up for grabs. As the war ended, the United States began to implement the plans that had been laid out. And there are various strata of planning had to be, with various degrees of centrality in the global planning. There was a kind of a contradiction in the plans that had to be resolved. It was described pretty aptly recently by Gerald Haynes, who's a well-known diplomatic historian and also the senior historian of the CIA, who in a recent book points out that, incorrectly, that the United States, after World War II, in its own interest, took over responsibility for the welfare of the world capitalist system. So the U.S. was standing for the world capitalist system generally, but in its own interest. He's correct about that. On the other hand, there was a kind of a contrary drive, which was expressed in secret documents by one of the leading architects of the post-war world, George Kennan, who was the head of the State Department policy planning staff, did much of the implementation of grand area planning in the late 1940s. He pointed out that, this is secret, so later public, that the United States has 50% of the world's wealth, that's part of the incomparable power, and it was true. The U.S. had 50% of the world's wealth, approximately, but only about 6% of its population. And he said that's a situation that creates envy and resentment, and our major concern in the post-war period, he said, must be to maintain this disparity. Well, he then went on to explain that this means that we must put aside vague and idealistic slogans about human rights and democratization and raising of the living standards and be prepared to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better, he said. Kennan, incidentally, is on the humanist soft end of the spectrum. He was thrown out a few years later because he was considered too soft-hearted for this tough world, and replaced by Paul Nitze, who's a hardliner. So at the very extreme, sort of dovish, humane end, that's the way it sounded on the inside. This is, of course, for internal consumption. For external consumption, you're allowed to, in fact, must have plenty of talk about vague and idealistic slogans that internally you regard as absurd and unacceptable. But you can see that there is a conflict. On the one hand, we have to maintain the disparity between our enormous wealth and everyone else's misery, and at the same time, we have to have responsibility for the world capitalist system in our own interest. It follows from the logic of that other sectors of the world capitalist system will have to be reconstructed in our interest, and indeed that was done. So the primary aspect of the core element of global planning was to reconstruct the major rich industrial countries. And it was understood that the main ones would be Germany in the European area and Japan in the Pacific. They had demonstrated their prowess in the years just before, and the world system had to be reconstructed around what were called its natural leaders, the great workshops, Germany and Japan. And in fact, the United States would reconstruct their power systems, but now under our control. So as Kennan explained, with regard to the Far East, we would reconstruct Japan's empire toward the south. That was the phrase he used. We had just fought a war to keep them from developing it themselves, but we were perfectly happy for them to have it as long as it was within our overarching control. And the same for German-based Europe, in Europe. The reason why this was in the U.S. interest was pretty obvious. The U.S. had a huge manufacturing surplus as a result of during the Second World War. The U.S. economy just boomed. Industrial production more than tripled. It pulled the United States out of depression. It taught to the corporate managers who flocked to Washington the lesson that it was possible to maintain a private profit system as long as the government poured huge amounts of public funds into it. That was an extremely important lesson, and it was taught to exactly the people who could benefit from it, the corporate managers who flocked to Washington to run the sort of semi-command economy that was very effective. Totalitarianism is an extremely efficient economic system, and during the Second World War we had a kind of voluntary totalitarianism. People were dedicated to the war effort, wages were kept down, There was allocation of resources. Profits went way up, I should say. The patriotic commitments extend only so far. But the results were that there was an enormous concentration of private capital and a tremendous industrial capacity, but nobody to buy the goods, because most of the rest of the world was either pretty seriously damaged or completely destroyed. So on the one hand, the capital had to be invested, and it had to be invested abroad. And the richest places for investment, the most profitable, were at that time not places like Indonesia, but places like Western Europe and Japan. So they'd be reconstructed as areas for investment of U.S. capital along with Canada. And then it was necessary to rebuild markets for U.S. industrial production. Otherwise, U.S. would be in trouble. And the markets could only be the other wealthy industrial powers, on any substantial scale at least. So on the one hand, it was necessary to maintain the disparity by violence, if necessary. On the other hand, it was necessary to reconstruct the wealthy industrial societies around Japan and Germany, our recent enemies, and reconstitute for them the imperial systems that enabled them to maintain their wealth and power. This meant a step that the economic planning was quite sophisticated, and it was very thought out in considerable detail. The idea was to set up triangular trade patterns whereby the United States would purchase raw materials from the colonies of the West, say from, you know, rubber from Malaya, which was a British colony, say, and so on. And the dollars that go to the purchase of these commodities would go back to the mother country, essentially. And that was supposed to be true even after independence, because the independence was supposed to be kind of like a mask for maintaining the old imperial relations. So the effect would be that U.S. purchase of raw materials from the third world would provide dollars to the imperial countries, and they would then be able to purchase U.S. Manufactured products with those dollars, thus overcoming what was called the dollar gap. The dollar gap was a major problem for American planners right in the end of the Second World War. In fact, the dollar gap was really only overcome by the huge military expenditures, the huge rearmament programs, which revitalized the Japanese economy and revitalized the European economies, and did in fact provide them dollars to maintain the viability of the system, while the same military spending maintained the U.S. economy. I'll come back to that in a moment. So the first international problem was reconstitute the major industrial powers. Various means were tried. The one that triangular trade patterns were part of it. The other one that succeeded was international, that was sometimes called international military Keynesianism, public funding of military systems which revitalized the internationally rich industrial societies. Now, of course, that meant that the third world, the former colonies, had to maintain their subordinate, had to be compelled to maintain their subordinate relations to the rich industrial countries, even though there was decolonization going on. So the United States was at war virtually with third world nationalism from the very beginning, and for very substantial reasons. And this was well understood. It was understood that, and in fact, if you look at the State Department planning, say the Kennan's staff in the late 40s, sort of spelling out the details of grand area planning, they simply parceled the world out to the different imperial centers. The United States was going to take for itself the Western Hemisphere, what the Secretary of War called our little region over here, which has never bothered anybody. So that meant kicking out our traditional enemies, Britain and France, and they were summarily dismissed, and the U.S. took total control over the Western Hemisphere. The other area that the U.S. was not going to brook any interference was the Middle East, which was described as the greatest strategic prize in history, an unparalleled source of wealth because of its oil. So the British were allowed in. They were considered kind of clients or lieutenants, but nobody else was. That had to be run completely by U.S. oil companies and by the United States. And in fact, the Monroe Doctrine was more or less extended to the Middle East. So these regions would be U.S. fiefdoms, Latin America and the Middle East, the oil-producing regions, but the other areas were kind of distributed. Africa was to be handed over to Europe to be exploited, as George Kennan put it, again expressing the more humanist end of the, to be exploited for its reconstruction, more humanist end of the spectrum, because the U.S. didn't care much about Africa, so the Europeans could have that one. Southeast Asia was to be a source of resources and raw materials for the Western powers, and the imperial systems would in effect be reconstructed. Japan's empire toward the south, the British system, the Dutch system, and so on, sometimes under the mask of independence, but sometimes just kept as colonies. The Vietnam War grows out of that. It was also understood there were problems in implementing this. In fact, there were problems right in Europe. One problem was that over the whole world, in fact, the anti-fascist resistance had a lot of prestige, and the traditional conservative order was more or less discredited, very much discredited by its association with fascism and Nazism. But the U.S. intended to reconstruct the traditional conservative order and the traditional power relations and undermine and dismantle the anti-fascist resistance, which was worker and peasant-based very often, and radical democratic or social democratic or communist or something like that in its orientation. And this had to be done all over the world, and it was done in different ways. In some countries, it was done with extreme violence. So in South Korea, for example, about 100,000 people were killed by the U.S. forces and the U.S. client regime before what we call the Korean War. That's not called the Korean War. A Korean War is supposed to be 1950, but it was in fact an episode in an ongoing struggle after the dismantling and destruction of the anti-fascist resistance, indeed even using Japanese police and military forces as clients. In Greece, about 160,000 people were killed as the Nazi collaborators and former wealthy sectors were reinstated, and the anti-fascist resistance, worker and peasant-based, which had fought quite a significant war. It had held down 6 or 7 German divisions. It was dismantled and destroyed. In other countries, it was done in other ways, but it was done everywhere. This was a uniform policy. And in fact, it did pretty much restore the traditional conservative order. Italy was the main target of U.S. subversion. It's not too well known, but the major CIA activities, as far as we know, as far as has been publicized, from 1947, when the CIA was founded, up until 1975, when the record runs dry. We don't know the subsequent record, but because there aren't documents. But during that period, Italy appears to have been the prime target of subversion. And the subversion was taken very seriously to block and undermine Italian democracy, because it was going to be worker-based or social democratic or something like that. The U.S. took it extremely seriously. The 1948 election in Italy, the first National Security Council documents, NSC1, in fact, they go in order. The first one, NSC1, is concerned with Italy, and it's concerned with what would happen if the communists, which means the working class-based political organization, if they won the election, as everyone expected they would. The U.S. Secretly was committed to calling a national emergency, getting the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean in action, and in fact starting paramilitary guerrilla operations in Italy to overthrow the government in case the wrong people won the democratic election. That tragedy didn't happen because the U.S. was able to control food and aid to Italy, which was then starving, in order to make sure that people voted the right way. And that was considered a great victory for democracy at the time, which tells you something about the concept of democracy. But anyway, and then subversive activities continued up until close to instigation of a military coup, apparently, around late 60s or the early 70s. This was quite an operation. And as I say, it was different in different countries, but it was successfully achieved. In the Western Hemisphere, there was a problem that's of a kind that's sometimes called clash of civilizations in these inflated days. There was a clash of civilizations in between the United States and Latin America. It's described quite revealingly in the internal record, which we now have. It came to a head in February 1945, so by the time of Yalta, when the war was almost over and, you know, about carrying out the post-war planning. Recall, as I said, Britain and France were kicked out. They had been the major powers in South America, but their day was over. The U.S. was taking over. The problem was that the Latin Americans had their own ideas, which were contrary to our ideas. Ideas of the Latin America, and that's the clash of civilizations. It came to a head in a hemispheric conference that was held in Chapultepec, Mexico, in February 1945, where the U.S. was trying to institute what it called a charter for the Americas, and the Latin American countries were very much opposed. They were under the sway of what the State Department, this is internal documents, what it called the philosophy of the new nationalism, which held that that the prime beneficiaries of a country's resources should be the people of that country, quoting, and that development should be based on domestic needs and should aim at broad distribution and development. And the United States was totally opposed to that. U.S. policy is that the prime beneficiaries of a country's resources are foreign investors, not the people of that country, and that independent development was unacceptable. There must be what was called complementary development complementary to the interests of U.S. private power. So, for example, Brazil, a potentially rich, very rich country, was allowed to develop the steel industry, but only those aspects of steel that U.S. steel corporations didn't want to produce, like, you know, cheap, low-tech steel, but not high-tech, because that wouldn't be complementary. And the U.S. won, of course, you know, given the power relations. So the philosophy of the new nationalism was beaten back. The prime beneficiaries of Latin America's resources are American U.S. investors and their own little wealthy sector that works with them. There is no independent development. There's no attempt at broader distribution of wealth. And in fact, you can read the World Bank year after year where they deplore the fact that Latin America has the worst economic inequality in the world, but nobody would be so unkind as to trace that fact back to the clash of civilizations in 1945 and the policies that were then carried out to keep it that way, often with brutal intervention, I should say, and murderous military dictatorships and so on, particularly starting from the Kennedy period. Anyhow, that was the Western Hemisphere, and different parts of the world went their different ways. Southeast Asia, the threat of economic nationalism, independent nationalism, is what led to the Vietnam War, and that threat was crushed. And similarly around the world, we can run through it. Well, how about domestically inside the United States? Recall that there had been a Great Depression in the 1930s, and any lingering illusions that capitalism might be a viable system had disappeared. Nobody had any such illusions. The question was what to do about it. The New Deal measures had very limited effect. You take a look around 1939, things were sort of softer, but people maybe were a little more hopeful, but the basic economic problems were about the same. On the other hand, the war got over. The war overcame the problems, got the country out of the depression. As I mentioned, industrial production zoomed, private power zoomed, and everybody knew how it had been done. It had been done by funneling public funds through state power into the hands of private industry, and that worked. And then came the post-war period, the wartime, you know, the war production system declined. There was a lot of pent-up, a lot of money. People saved a lot of money by working, and they hadn't been able to spend it. So there was, it was possible for a couple of years to sort of keep the thing going on consumption. But by around 1948 or so, 47 or 48, there was a lot of fear that the country was going to head right back to the Depression. And they already knew how to get around that. The way to get around it was to restore the role of state power in funneling public funds into the pockets of wealthy people. That's what it amounts to. And they also knew the best way of doing it, namely the Pentagon. And that was understood. There's nothing here, you don't have to go to secret records. If you go to the business press in the late 1940s, it discusses all of this quite openly. So Fortune magazine, describing the aeronautical industry, pointed out that by, I think, 1947, that the aeronautical industry cannot survive in a and a competitive, unsubsidized free enterprise economy. And then Business Week added that the government has to be the savior. And if you go over to Steel magazine or the magazine of Wall Street, they pointed out that military funding would be the magic elixir that would keep the system going for endless good times. Business Week was very concerned that Stalin's peace offensives might be, that Washington might be unable to resist them. But they were pleased that they were able to resist them. They said, Stalin's, you know, Washington resists the peace offensives, we can keep the military spending going. And it was perfectly understood. There was no subterfuge, that this is the way to maintain the private enterprise economy. The first Secretary of the Air Force, Stuart Symington, later became known as the senator from Boeing when he moved over to the Senate, described his role in the state as Secretary of Air Force to be to ensure that adequate military procurement funds go to Boeing, and he explained publicly, incidentally, that the word to use is not subsidy, the word to use is security. And in other words, you can sort of fool people into being frightened, you can get them to transfer public funds over to the hands of private industry. The aeronautical industry is no small business, incidentally. It's the biggest civilian exporter in the United States. It's able to be a civilian exporter because the public pays most of the costs of research and development and even provides a market through the military system. And that expands into all sorts of other things, into avionics, electronics, metallurgy, and virtually every aspect of the advanced economy. In the 1950s, research and development in electronics was about 85% public funded. In computers, it was about 100% public funded, through the Pentagon or through the Department of Energy or the or later NASA, which was Kennedy's innovation about trying to figure out a way to get the public to pay for the costs of private profit. And that whole system, this sort of state system of subsidy and transfer of funds, we call it welfare if we were honest, but it's the reverse sort, you know, poor to the rich, so it's not called welfare. This is a huge system of transfer of funds which maintains private power and private profit. That's one reason why the Pentagon system doesn't decline with the end of the Cold War. Nobody knows any alternative way of doing it. I mean, you know, economists can figure out technical alternatives, but they're irrelevant because it was well understood. If you take an economics course, I'm sure you've studied it here, you know, as Keynes pointed out, you can bury dollars in the sand and it'll also funnel funds into the economy. You could use social spending, building hospitals and roads. I mean, that'll prime an economy. Or you can do it through the military. You can do it in a lot of different ways. And they're more or less intertranslatable. However, economists don't look at another problem, and that is they have different power consequences. And business did look at those consequences. So if you read, say, Business Week in the late 1940s, they were well aware as the, scientists, that there were a lot of different ways of getting the government to pour public funds into maintaining the economy, but they much preferred military spending, and they explained why. There's a problem with social spending. Social spending has a democratizing effect. People care about where there's a hospital or a road or something like that. They have no opinions about what kind of jet fighter to build. So they don't get involved. They just leave it to somebody else. And if that jet fighter happens to subsidize the advanced sectors of industry, well, okay, then we're doing it on the sly. Furthermore, social spending tends to have a redistributive effect, whereas military spending concentrates private power and profit in high-tech corporations, managerial sectors, investment banks, some skilled workers and managers, and so on. So it has a counter-redistributive effect. If the government's involved in the production of anything useful, say, it interferes with private profit. On the other hand, if the government is just producing waste, which is, from an economic point of view, what military goods are, just waste, basically, and furthermore, rapidly obsolescing waste, because you have to keep replacing it all the time. If the government's producing rapidly obsolescing waste, that's a gift to the corporate manager. It doesn't interfere with profit. Also, it happened to be very well geared at that point to the needs of the industrial economy. The industrial economy, if you think about how it was developing at the time, you know, with around, say, electronics and computers and all, you know, various, those, the sectors of high tech that were on the cutting edge, happened to be very close to the ones that were directly related to military production. So what you had, the Pentagon system was almost perfect. Perfect welfare system. Enhanced private power, undermined democracy, had a counter-redistributive effect. Just a gift to the corporate manager. The purchasing may not be a large percentage, but it was like a cushion for spending, which makes a big difference. And research and development, other the costs were paid by the public, and then the profit went over to the private sector. And that system remains coming up to the present. That's our current system. So if you look at, it's pretty dramatic when you look at what's happening. Let's bring it up to the present and I'll stop. This world system, incidentally, has changed somewhat over the years, undoubtedly. Like, for example, there's been a huge, in the 1970s, it was a tremendous explosion of financial capital because of deregulation of the international economic system, of the financial system. That had a huge impact. The scale of that is pretty astonishing. So in around 1970, there was a system of regulated capital. So, you know, the dollar was the international currency. It was fixed relative to gold. Other currencies were fixed relative to the dollar within a very limited range. That was the Bretton Woods arrangement. Richard Nixon dismantled it in the early 1970s. The U.S. is powerful enough to do what it wants, so, and couldn't sustain that position. And the effects of that were enormous. At the time, around 1970, before this, about 90% of the capital in international exchanges was related to the real economy, meaning it was either for investment or manufacturing or trade, something like that, and about 10% was speculative. By 1990, those figures had reversed. About 90% was speculative. The latest report I've seen from the UN, 1994, was about 95% speculative, 5% real economy related. Furthermore, the scale has just exploded. I mean, there's now about $1 trillion a day or so moving around on international exchanges. This speculative capital drives down growth rates. It makes it very difficult for a government to carry out stimulative economic policies of any kind. Because if it does, the capital's going to move somewhere else, because they don't want growth. That's why you get headlines in the papers now saying, you know, Wall Street fears economic growth or something, or, you know, economic growth feared, we have to reduce it. Economic growth is now considered an evil, which has to be beaten down. And there's a huge amount of capital around. It overwhelms governments, even rich ones like ours. And that was already understood by the economics profession in the late 70s. James Tobin, in a presidential address to the American Economic Association in 1978, Nobel Prize winning economist, already pointed out that the growth of financial capital was going to drive the world to a low wage, low growth, and he didn't say it, but high profit economy, unproductive high profit economy. And he suggested various means to mitigate this, which were not undertaken. They're still sort of on the table. But anyway, that's a big change. Another big change that took place around the same time, partly related to this, partly related to the growth of telecommunications and so on, was that it became a lot easier to globalize production, meaning to have your corporate headquarters in, say, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut, and your branch office in Zurich, and your production facilities in Indonesia and or Poland or some place like that, wherever you can get the cheapest labor at the worst conditions and so on. It became much easier to do that, which put an enormous amount of power into the hands of private capital. And private capital, remember, means private tyranny. These are unaccountable private organizations of enormous scale. There's a lot of, you have to be a little careful because of this, and thinking this, obviously you don't even have to, there's a lot of talk about shifting jobs, but You don't have to shift jobs. You just have to threaten to shift jobs. That's enough to get people to accept higher working hours, lower wages, cutting down benefits, and so on. And this is a global phenomenon. So, you know, the United States is doing it more than others, but other countries following along. So these are big changes. But a lot of it remains quite stable. And in fact, one of the things that has happened, I'll end with this, is that a combination of protectionism and state subsidy in the rich countries and imposing free market conditions on the poor countries, that double-edged policy, which is the standard one, goes back to the 18th century. That's what free markets really are. Nobody accepts free markets for themselves. You always ram them down someone else's throats. But that division, those dual policies have sharpened the division between the poor and the rich quite substantially in the last years. So if you take the rich countries and the poor countries, say the top 20% and the bottom 20%, the gap between them approximately doubled from 1960 to 1990 as a combination of the much higher protectionism in the rich countries and the imposition of free market policies in the poor countries. I mean, that's how they separated in the first place. The first world and the third world were pretty similar in the 18th century. But the rich countries like us and England and so on followed highly protectionist policies, and the poor countries were forced into market policies, which led a major factor that led to the difference. Since 1960, that escalated, but even more strikingly, if you take the richest 20% of the population across the countries and the poorest 20% across the countries, the gap there increased much more sharply, got to about 60 to 1 between the countries and about 140 to 1 in the populations, which means that the internally to the various countries, including by now us, the richest country, the gap between the rich and the poor is spreading very fast. What that's doing is internationalizing the third world model. It's bringing it to the rich countries as well. Meaning typical third world country has a small sector of extreme wealth and privilege, sometimes unbelievable wealth and privilege, and then a huge mass of people who are living in misery, and an awful lot of people who are just superfluous. They're the ones you send the death squads after, or you carry out social cleansing and so on. That's the standard third world model, and that's being internationalized, with the United States in the lead, because we're the most powerful country, so we sort of lead the way. The inequality in the United States is the greatest in the industrial world. This is the richest country in the world with by far unparalleled advantages. So the complete catastrophic failure of the economic system is dramatically obvious here. The poverty level is about twice that of any other country. Wages have now dropped to lower than any other industrial country, with the exception of England, which has done even a better job under Thatcher of smashing down its own working people. This was called in the Wall Street Journal a welcome development of transcendent importance when they noticed it a couple of years ago, showing how wages have dropped relative to other countries since 1985. Through this combination of highly protectionist policies for the rich and essentially market principles, so free market principles for the poor. Poor means a large majority of the population in the country and in the world. Well, those policies are now being accelerated. That's essentially what the Republican Congress is about. So they call themselves, you know, they have a lot of talk about the free market, but if you look, it's the traditional double-edged free market. So cut down, you know, school lunches, but increase subsidies to the rich. That's the way it's working across the board. It becomes very dramatic if you look at it close. It works in precise detail. Sometimes it's even pretty dramatic. So, for example, during the debate over school lunches, you remember a couple of weeks ago, Representative David Obey submitted a kind of a harassment amendment. He didn't really expect it to pass, and it didn't. He proposed that they keep $7 billion in school lunches and pay for it by delaying the deployment of the F-22 stealth fighter. Not stopping the deployment, but just delaying it for a couple of years. That would have paid the $7 billion for school lunches. Well, of course, that, you know, never even got to a vote. It was so ridiculous. The F-22 fighter is a $72 billion welfare program, which goes primarily to Newt Gingrich's constituents. The Lockheed Corporation is now Lockheed Martin, you know, merge to big military systems. Its headquarters is Cobb County, Georgia, his district. His district happens to get more federal subsidies than any suburban district in the country, with the exception of Arlington, Virginia, which is part of Washington, actually. It's, you know, where the Pentagon is and so on. And Brevard County, Florida, which is where the Kennedy Space Center is, another part of the system of welfare for the rich. So if you move out of the federal system itself, Gingrich is sitting in the place which gets more welfare than any place in the country. So it's really easy when you've got the nanny state pouring money into your pocket to be a, you know, conservative and denounce the nanny state and let's have tough love for everybody else and so on and so forth, as long as there's no tough love for us rich folk. And this goes right across the board. The Heritage Foundation, which is the, you know, ultra-right foundation, just came out with its budget proposals, which is cut down everything that could possibly help any person, but increase the military budget. Not because we're under threat. You know, the idea that the U.S. is under threat is too ludicrous to discuss. But because rich people are under threat. The threat is that the corporate profits, which have shot through the roof, might not shoot through another roof. That's the threat. So while real wages have been declining, from about 1980, there's been a steady decline of median real wages and an increase in working hours right through the Clinton recovery, incidentally. Corporate profits are absolutely booming. In 1993, Fortune magazine, you know, every year at the end of the year, they run a thing on the Fortune 500, the big 500 rich corporations, and they described it, they just couldn't contain themselves. It was a dazzling year for profits. Even though sales growth, they said, was stagnating, but profits were going way up. Well, that was 1993. The figures have just come out for 1994. It was much, much better. Business Week and Fortune and the other journals are, you know, they're saying business has a problem. It has so much money coming out of its coffers that it doesn't know what to do with it. The last quarter of 1964 broke all records and will probably go up again. And remember that that's not any longer the sole source of huge capital concentration, because that's now shifted to a large extent to financial capital, places like Goldman Sachs and the people of Bill Clinton's cabinet. That's another big concentration of capital, the function of which is mostly to drive down growth and increase inequality. Well, this is a combination of, and so the Pentagon budget has to go up, of course, and the entire welfare system for the rich, of which this is only a piece. Well, I've talked too long already, but the main point is that the policies are quite understandable, quite intelligent, well thought out, self-conscious, designed to, as much as possible, internationalize the third world model. And it's working, with the United States in the lead. It's a pretty ominous future, I think. Nobody knows if you can really carry it off. It's sort of an experiment. They're kind of trying to roll back the whole welfare state, the social contract that was developed over about 100 years of struggle, see if you can get back to, you know, the 1820s or something like that. And how far it'll go before the place erupts is extremely hard to know. One concomitant that you see in the United States, there's been a very sharp decline in welfare. The United States has one of the worst welfare systems in the world, with very little welfare, but it's dropped very sharply since about 1970, about half, in fact. While welfare for the rich through the military system and so on has shot up, and that's going to continue. And what it'll mean, nobody knows. One effect is you do have a superfluous population. That's why the prison population has been shooting out of sight. The United States is now in the lead per capita in the world in imprisoning its population, and that's going to go way up. California, there was just a Rand Corporation study that predicted that last year, for the first time, they spent more on prisons than on education. They used to have the best educational public education system in the world. And the Rand Corporation predicted that they're now going to definitely spend about 40% of the state, more of the state budget for prisons, which means the educational system will pretty well collapse, they concluded. Not for rich people. I mean, they're always going to have what they like. But for the general population. And that's the direction that things are going. How long people will accept it, you really don't know. Part of the reason, I think, for the crazy cultism and hysteria and so on that's going around the country is sort of an unfocused kind of reaction to all of this. And where it's going to go, no one knows, but I don't think it looks very pretty. Well.
heard that there are a number of Japanese companies that are trying to perfect an electrode for cold fusion. And perhaps cold fusion has been mistaken as a nuclear reaction. Maybe it's a chemical reaction, but there's something going on there. If they were able to come up with an alternative, a safe alternative to fossil fuels, and as Arthur C. Clarke has said, the third world would have electricity, like all of India would have electricity within a decade, how would that affect the balance of power in the world?
Well, cold fusion is pretty much of a gamble. I don't think there are many scientists who think it's very plausible. Maybe there's something there. The much more plausible, I suppose, is hot fusion, you know, the fusion that they're working on at Princeton and places like that, and nobody knows if that can work either. It's a real gamble. Actually, funding for it has been cut way back. The Energy Department is cutting back funding on alternative, non-hydrocarbon fuels, alternative fuels, but is increasing funding all over, overall, because it's increasing the weapons funding so fast. That's Clinton's Energy Department. My own guess is that if something came along, say photovoltaic cells, for solar energy or anything else that could be used for people generally, it would probably be stopped because it's unprofitable.
How would it be stopped?
Very simple. You just stop funding it. You stop funding it and you stop. Look, there's a very high concentration of power in the world. Most of it's here. And that concentration of power is around private power. And they basically make the decisions. I mean, now it's such a grotesque power play that even the press can't believe it. Like, big corporations are just writing the legislation, not even behind the scenes. So you see an article every other day in the Times about, you know, the lobbyists for the big corporations are describing to the press what the legislation is while the congressmen listen. It used to be at least behind the scenes. My suspicion is that if anything of a real democratizing character came along, it would probably be stopped. There's a lot of questions to ask about this that nobody really looks into much, so you can only guess. But let me suggest the question that you might want to think about. Why is tobacco legal and marijuana illegal? Okay, why? I mean, marijuana became illegal around the early 30s, right after Prohibition ended. And there was a huge federal bureaucracy that had to control something, and so on. They didn't have alcohol anymore, so they switched to marijuana. Well, why not tobacco? Tobacco is much more dangerous, way more dangerous. I mean, there aren't even any known deaths from overdose from marijuana. It's probably not good for, I'm sure it's not good for you, but you know, a lot of things aren't good for you, like say coffee. But tobacco is just a killer, and it not only kills the people who are smoking it; it kills a lot of other people too. Deaths from passive smoking are probably in the tens of thousands every year. It's recently been estimated that of the people alive in China today, about 50 million of those under 20 will probably die from tobacco-related diseases. The latest research findings here were that in the United States, about 5,000 or 6,000, I forget how many, children, infants, are killed every year because their mothers are smoking. I mean, these are big numbers, way beyond hard drugs. So how come marijuana is illegal and tobacco is legal? You know, why not the other way around, say? Well, I think there's some pretty obvious reasons. Marijuana is a weed. You can grow it in your backyard. You know, anybody can grow it. Tobacco is an industrial crop. You have to have subsidies. You know, you have to have capital funding. You have to have protection and so on. You can make a lot of money from tobacco. If marijuana is legal, everybody can grow it. Nobody's going to make any money from it. That's a possible difference. It's never been investigated, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's a factor. And the same could well be true about solar energy.
I would just like to suggest that the Department of Energy, there are little, you know, fiefdoms within places like MIT, the hot fusion versus cold fusion group.
I don't think.
Hans and Fleischmann were forced out of this country.
Yeah, but
by the Japanese.
You got to be careful, though. They were not forced out of the country. The research was, in fact, deeply flawed, and serious problems were found in it. The scientific community internally isn't that corrupt. It can't be. You know, it's not that they have better genes or something. It's corruption inside the science is extremely difficult, because if you sort of lie about an experiment, somebody will redo it the next day and show you. In other fields outside the sciences, it's a lot easier to be deceitful. You know, you come out with a fraudulent theory of the French Revolution or something, you know, nobody's going to expose it. And in the political world, it's, of course, a totally different story. So I would be cautious about thinking about, of say, Ponton Fleischmann being driven out for this reason. Actually, the research was very flawed. Maybe there's something to it, and there is some Japanese capital investing in it. But I wouldn't, I don't know much about this subject. What I hear from scientists around MIT who do know is very skeptical. Whereas hot fusion is conceivable, but has big problems, very serious problems. If it works, it would be a real breakthrough, but nobody really knows. There are big materials problems, you know, all sorts of things that people don't know about. There isn't a technological fix for everything, you know, like Newt Gingrich may think. It sort of comes free, but it doesn't. Some things may have technological fixes, some may not. Like global warming may not, you know. You just can't assume that technology is going to fix things. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. On the other hand, things like, say, solar energy, well, nobody knows the potential, but it's striking that very little research money goes into it. And if it worked, then it would be much more democratized. Everybody could have it, you know. In fact, there are countries where it's used, even though it's inefficient. It could be used, for example, for things like desalination, if it worked, which is a big problem in large parts of the more arid parts of the world, which is a large part of the world, they just don't have water. You know, I mean, we're used to having water, but you go to plenty of places in the world and they just don't. Yeah.
Do you foresee in our future, the United States future, that as we lead the way towards becoming internally a third world country, that there'll be some sort of like lower class insurrection or a socialist revolt?
So could you hear? Well, he asked a very sensible question. If the United States continues this move, which is in fact accelerating, towards turning it into a third world country with big superfluous population, very high concentration of wealth and so on, will there be some kind of a insurrection or, you know, rebellion or something? Well, I think you already see the signs of it. So, for example, take the cults are a sign of it, in my opinion. So this is a very disorganized country. We don't have a civil society. The people are isolated and alone. The unions have been destroyed. There's no political parties. There's no political organizations. Most people don't think there's anything they can do. I mean, I suppose that's why about 40% of the population says they spend all or most of their time watching The Simpsons Drive. And very few people vote. People just don't vote in this country because they think there's nothing to vote for. You know, you ask people. There's regular polls because business wants to know what people are thinking. They have huge propaganda systems, and they therefore want to know what people are thinking. And about half the population says both political parties ought to be disbanded because they're just working for a few big interests looking out for themselves. The propaganda system is designed to keep private power secret. You don't see it. You're not supposed to know it's there. What you see is government. So corporate propaganda, which is extraordinary in scale, I mean billions of dollars a year from television and movies to books and everything else, is designed to suppress private power. It's to suppress the existence of profits. This has reached the point where the word profits is unusable in the United States. It's kind of like a four-letter word. When the press wants to refer to profits, they call it jobs. So, for example, when it's like a joke these days. When Clinton went to the APEC meeting, the Asia-Pacific meeting in Indonesia, he came back talking about he'd gotten terrific jobs for Americans, a $40 billion contract for Exxon to develop a natural gas field in off Indonesia, which, you know, great jobs for Americans all over the place. The Exxon stock shot up because all the investors were so excited about the new jobs for Americans. If you ask how many jobs for Americans were there, well, you know, a couple of corporate managers, maybe a few skilled workers, but there was something that was going to go up, namely profits for some Americans, but you simply are not allowed to say that. The Wall Street Journal had a front page story just a couple days ago saying big U.S. oil companies are worried about the fact that the Europeans are getting into the Iraqi fields ahead of us. You know, they might. And it says oil companies fear loss of jobs in Iraq. Yeah, that's just what they fear. But the point is, profits are invisible. You know, they, you don't mention them even. And similarly, private power is invisible. But you do mention the government. People have to hate something, so they better hate the government. Not that there isn't a lot to hate, but the government has a defect that private power doesn't have. The government is accountable. People can in some... There's a method, at least. Maybe it's not used, but at least it's possible in principle to influence what the government does. It is impossible in principle to influence what General Motors does or Goldman Sachs. They are tyrannies, huge tyrannies. So the idea is to try to transfer decision-making power over to them and make people hate the government. This has been going on for 50 years. And it has its effects. The effects are people hate and fear the government. And that, it's a kind of an insurrection, if you like, but a pretty irrational one. I think Oklahoma City is probably an example of it. So there's an awful lot of irrational cultism going on in the country. It's a very funny country as compared with others. Very free, you know, maybe the freest country in the world. But it's also, in many respects, like a kind of devastated peasant society in cultural respects. This is not a joke. Like if you look at, say, religious fanaticism, there are various cross-cultural measures of it. It's usually inversely correlated with industrialization. You know, a country gets more industrialized, there's less religious fanaticism. But the United States is right, is totally off the chart. It's like the poorest devastated peasant societies in the world in terms of religious fanaticism. And this is true across the board. So I think there's a kind of an insurrection. I don't think you're wrong. And I think that we already see it, but it's just taking very unconstructive forms. And I think it's very dangerous. In fact, it's kind of reminiscent of, you know, Germany in the late 30s, or maybe Iran around 1980s, you know, and there was a lot of unfocused resentment and fear, and it didn't go in a pretty direction. I can't see up there, I'm afraid. Oh, yeah.
Jay?
Somebody standing up?
Jay, yes.
Why don't you, because I can't see from where I am, if you can call me.
You said that every president since World War II has committed a impeachable offense. You didn't say that.
No, I said worse than that. I said every president since World War II would be hanged by the standards of Nuremberg.
In this lecture, you've attacked those who attack democracy, but you haven't really addressed the nature of democracy. So, What, given that all our democratically elected presidents have been basically...
I don't say they've been bad people. I've said that they've committed crimes. Maybe they're nice people. That's a different issue.
They've all been unfit for office. Then what do you think is the proper role of democracy? And can it work? And if it can, what should we
do? Oh, I think we should have... I'm very much in favor of democracy, and I'm very much opposed to the fact that it's disintegrated in the United States. It's disintegrated to the point where it's virtually a form. I mean, take, say, the 1994 elections. Which were called a landslide for, you know, conservatism. If you take a look, a little over a third of the electorate voted. That was split about 50% of the, about 50.3, you know, a little over 50% voted for the Republicans. So that's like around 18% of the electorate. Of the voters, one out of six said that they even knew about or cared about the Republican agenda. Like, say, even if every one of those one out of six was in favor of it, which is unlikely, that gives you about 5% of the electorate voting for the agenda. That's called a landslide victory. Well, you know, that's just a way of saying democracy's collapsed. You know, people, right today, you know, after 6 months of intense propaganda, under 40% of the population has ever heard of the contract with America. You know, and it's been, you know, like it's not hidden. I mean, headlines every day. Well, all these things are just signs of the collapse of democracy, and that's a big victory for business. They have been fighting for this for years. At the end of the second, I mentioned that in other countries they had to destroy the anti-fascist resistance and so on, but something similar happened here too. The U.S. population was very social democratic after the Second World War. I'm very pro-union. It wanted more government involvement in industry. I mean, across the board, and business was scared. They, in fact, said that they have about 5 or 6 years to save the private enterprise system. And they launched a huge propaganda program. In the early 1950s, about one out of three textbooks in schools was simply provided by business. They had 20 or 30 million people a week watching propaganda films. The Taft-Hartley bill allowed propaganda in the company, meaning you had a captive audience, you just had to watch propaganda. The Advertising Council was spending huge amounts of money to propagandize for what they called, you know, the American way, meaning, you know, and so on. Part of the effect of this was to undermine and destroy unions, to undermine and destroy political parties, to separate and atomize people, you know, so that they're isolated. They really do watch the Simpson trial. And that's the decline of democracy. And the answer to it is to reconstruct democratic systems. That means grassroots organizations, political organizations, unions, structures in which people actually can participate in formulating and implementing policy. And of course, there is a, you know, there's an insight that goes back to Adam Smith that we're not allowed to think about any longer. If you're a real old-fashioned conservative and you're interested in people like Adam Smith and Thomas Jefferson, then there's something that you understand, and that is that private power is tyranny. So as Adam Smith put it, in England, which he was studying primarily, the most democratic country of the day, he said that state power is in the hands of merchants and manufacturers who use it. They're the principal architects of policy, and they use that state power to make sure that their own interests are most peculiarly attended to, in other words, well attended to, however grievous the impact on the people of England. And it was for exactly that reason that people like Thomas Jefferson were strongly opposed to the rise of corporations. Now, he could barely see them in his day, you know, they're just the bare beginning. It wasn't until the early 20th century that they got their current power as real tyrannies that was given to them by courts and lawyers. And it was understood at the time that this is, Jefferson said, if they ever grow, it'll mean we live under a worse absolutism than we overthrew during the revolution. These are trivialities. I mean, these are things that would be taught in fifth grade in a free country. And if people really were to study the classics like Adam Smith or Jefferson, that everybody would know it. But you're not allowed to think it, you know. And as long as that remains true, there's considerable limits on democracy because there's just too much private power. And by now, this private power is international. So a big corporate, take, say, Caterpillar, let's take something concrete. Half of the city of Decatur, a working-class city, is now on strike. The couple of big corporations, primarily Caterpillar, are trying to destroy the last union in the United States, the UAW, the last sort of functioning manufacturing union. Unions, whatever you think about them, are a democratizing force. They're a way for working people to get together, you know, to sort of enter into the political arena and so on, to compete with private concentration of power. How are they doing it? Caterpillar thinks it's going to win. They may be right. Part of the reason that they may be able to win, and they tell you, you know, you read it in the business pages, is that they have built, they have made huge profits, and they have used it not for economic gain, but to build up excess capacity in other countries. So they now have enough, they have enough excess capacity in places like Brazil to keep providing, filling their orders, even if they smash up the workforce in the United States. Well, that probably could be right. And other businesses are doing the same thing, but that just undermines democracy. Incidentally, I should also add that it undermines markets. Here's a point where I think economists aren't really doing their job properly. There's a lot of talk about the growth of international trade, which is supposed to show how wonderful the market is. But you take a look at that trade and you'll find that's a curious kind of growth. So about 50% of U.S. trade now is internal to corporations, which means there's about as much trade as if you move something from one shelf of a store to another. Just happens across a border, but it's centrally managed interactions with a very visible hand, with all kind of market distortions, which nobody studies much, but they're undoubtedly severe. And 50% is not a small amount. You know, that's a lot. Like when at the time of NAFTA, there was a lot of talk about our trade with Mexico, but there wasn't much talk about the fact that more than half of U.S. exports to Mexico were internal to corporations. So, like Ford Motor Company sending things over to, you know, get cheap work, cheap labor to put them together and then come back here to add more value. That's not exports. Didn't even enter the Mexican market. No. And those are huge components of trade. These trade, so-called trade agreements like GATT, it's not at all clear that they're going to increase trade in any authentic sense. They may reduce trade. I mean, they may increase stuff going across borders, but that's not quite the same as trade. You know, that's not market interactions. These are complicated matters, and you don't want to just sloganize about them. But in my opinion, there's a general attack on democracy and markets going on through the concentration of private power. And yeah, that's got to be dismantled, and the society has to be democratized. It's not a simple job. I mean, it begins with things like building grassroots popular organizations, like unions, or like political organizations, and then it should go on, community organizations and so on. That's the way to have a functioning democracy. So I think it's clear enough what to do. The problem is to get out and do it.
One final question, then we'll have to...
A government that the United States can learn from? I don't think we should try to learn from governments. We should learn from people. And there are a lot of people in the world we can learn from. So, for example, take something pretty close to home. Take this question of democratization. Let's take the poorest country in the hemisphere, Haiti. Okay, the poorest country in the hemisphere. Absolutely miserable conditions. I was there a little while ago. It's unbelievable. Living under terror and so on. They were able to develop a democratic society. The peasants of Haiti, living up in the hills, and the people living in the slums, while nobody was noticing it, they built up popular grassroots organizations which were strong enough to sweep their own president into power. It was a huge surprise to everyone because nobody paid any attention to what's happening in the slums and up in the hill. I mean, this talk about our going to Haiti to teach them democracy is just a joke. I mean, we ought to learn what democracy is from people living in the slums of Haiti under conditions that most of us can't imagine. You know, so there's a lot that we can learn from people. Not only there, plenty of places where people struggle and fight for their rights. But we're not going to learn anything from governments. You know, governments are, as John Dewey put it, a latter-day Jeffersonian, one of the last, they said the politics is the shadow cast by business over society, and the shadow varies in character in some place, depending on, you know, the power of popular organizations. You may have a better social contract or a worse one, but it's basically that. And as long as that's the case, governments are one or another part of that shadow. Or some other places, just straight tyrannies, you know, like military dictatorships or Stalin-style tyrannies or something. But governments aren't the kinds of things that you learn from, I don't think. You can learn a lot, however, from what people do, including people here. So, for example, during the 1980s in the United States, the solidarity movements with Central America, they can teach you a lot. There's nothing like them in history. You know, these were very mainstream American. Nobody ever talks about them because you're not allowed to know. But these were grassroots popular organizations, very mainstream, you know, conservative, Christian, middle-class communities with extreme dedication. I mean, they went way beyond anything in the 60s. And they made it, like, for example, in the 1960s, nobody thought of going to live in a Vietnamese village because maybe a white face would, you know, protect people from state terror that we were running or doing ourselves. But in the 1980s, plenty of people did that. They went to Central America to do that. That's unheard of in history, you know, and had a big effect. You know, I mean, like, a lot of people survived because of it. Well, you know, those are people you can learn something from, and they're all over the place. But they're not the ones that you're going to hear about in the propaganda institutions. Why should they tell you? You know, they're trying to de-democratize, not democratize. But it's possible to find out. Not very hard, in fact.
Hi, this is Roger Leisner for Radio Free Maine, and you've been listening to Noam Chomsky speaking on economic impact of post-World War II U.S. foreign policy, recorded on April 27, 1995 at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. A Radio Free Maine produced tape was reviewed in the music section of Playboy magazine, their May issue, 1995. For the first time, record and CD reviewers had decided to review a spoken word tape in the music section. The review was written by Charles Young and is as follows. The other day, I saw the words Chomsky Knows scratched into the wall of the toilet stall. This is how word of Noam Chomsky tends to spread. You hear the guy, your life changes, and you share the news however you can. He has been called the most quoted human living. as a professor at MIT. He is one of the most important linguists of the 20th century. What does this have to do with popular music? Well, as an anarchist, Chomsky has long been a hero to the punk subculture. Bad Religion put one of his lectures on the B-side of a single. As punk has permeated other forms of rock, Chomsky's influence has spread. Pearl Jam, for example, plugged Chomsky in a live radio broadcast, and producer Don Was plans to sample some of Chomsky's aphorisms for a compilation album. If you want to be hip, you have to listen to Chomsky. So where do you find him on tape? Send away to Radio Free Maine, P.O. Box 2705, Augusta, Maine, 04338. Area code 207-622-6629. Which has a vast catalog of his lectures, along with those of other dissident heroes, on audio cassettes and video cassettes. The role of the media in manufacturing consent is a particularly bracing analysis of the recent elections and the propaganda offensives of the American ruling class in the past 25 years. If you find the truth exhilarating, Noam Chomsky provides a better buzz than rock and roll. The tape was then placed in competition with other musical selections in the Rock Meter, Archers of Loaf, their album entitled Vivi, John Mayall, an old album, Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton, Marianne Faithfull, her comeback album, Secret Life, and a various artists' compilation, Murder Was the Case. Five judges on a scale of 1 to 10 judged the tape. Robert Christgau, Mr. Garbriani, Nelson George, David Marsh, and Chuck Young. The role of the media in manufacturing consent received 3/8 and 2/10. The 2/10 were from David Marsh and Chuck Young, both former writers for Rolling Stone magazine. I am very happy that Playboy decided to print this review. I tried to get it in other leftist journals, but they were not interested, seeming to think that people that listen to tapes are rather sort of lowlifes. So thank you all for listening to Radio Free Maine, and keep looking to music journals and magazines for more reviews of Radio Free Maine tapes. This is Roger Leisner for Radio Free Maine. Thank you and good night.